Across the Pacifica Network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 9, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Iraq's self-declaration is in, saying it has no weapons of mass destruction. Yet today, large-scale military exercises begin in countries surrounding Iraq. The Bush administration fires top economic advisers. And renowned peace activist Philip Berrigan has passed away from cancer. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United States and Great Britain are demonstrating their military prowess in the Persian Gulf today with what they are calling war games. In Qatar, they flew in more than 1,000 top war planners to test a $58 million computerized command center. Thousands of other personnel worldwide also participated. In the meantime, Turkish officials are coming to the United States to finalize their deal with U.S. officials, trading use of its country as a launching pad for an attack on Iraq in exchange for military equipment. Aaron Glantz has more from Istanbul.
The leader of Turkey's new Islamic government arrives in Washington after a visit by U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz got a big commitment from Turkey. The right to use American and Turkish bases to stage a war on Iraq if the war has the United Nations approval and consideration of a U.S. plan to mobilize 35,000 Turkish troops for the war. What the Turkish military gets in exchange is $3.5 billion in military aid, which it can use to buy weapons from U.S. companies like Halliburton, McDonnell Douglas, and Lockheed Martin. The Turkish military gets 90% of its weapons from U.S. companies. Turkey's army is the third largest in the world. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Istanbul.
An international doctors group warns of hundreds of thousands of casualties in case of a U.S. war with Iraq. Ed Rippey has more from Oakland.
At a press conference in Oakland, California this morning, the president of San Francisco Physicians for Social Responsibility and an investigator for International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War warned that war on Iraq could kill nearly 4 million people. Dr. Robert Gould of Physicians for Social Responsibility and Dr. David Levinson presented a report by MedAct, a British affiliate, estimating the medical consequences of the war, which would include famine and epidemics. Different scenarios gave death tolls ranging from 48,000 to nearly 4 million if the U.S. or Israel uses nuclear weapons. They urged the Bush administration not to go to war on Iraq. In Oakland, this is Ed Rippey for Free Speech Radio News.
A man is scheduled to be executed by the state of Florida today, even though his attorneys say he is insane and does not understand the nature and effect of the death penalty. Mitch Perry has more from Tampa.
Florida Governor Jeb Bush stunned death penalty opponents last week when he stayed the execution of convicted killer Amos King after he was convinced that King deserved to have new DNA tests done to determine if he was guilty of a 1977 killing. Then on Thursday of last week, Bush stayed the execution of Lynroy Bodison after his attorneys argued he was incompetent. Under state law, condemned prisoners cannot be executed unless they understand they will die and the reason why they are being put to death. But Bush was angry about staying Bodison's execution, saying the provision that requires examination after allegations of incompetency has become a loophole for death row attorneys. Court documents show that 40 years ago, Bodison attempted suicide in his church. He was taken to a psychiatric hospital and diagnosed as having had an acute schizophrenic episode. Bodison is condemned for the 1979 murder of Catherine Alexander, who was robbed, held captive for 83 hours, stabbed 16 times, and then crushed to death by a car. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
A Portland, Oregon man was sentenced to more than 3 years in prison for making a comment about a burning bush in a South Dakota bar one day before the president was scheduled to arrive in a nearby town. From KBOO in Portland, Andrew Stelzer has more.
Richard Humphreys was arrested in Sioux Falls after making the remark and indicted on a federal charge of threatening to kill or harm the president. The charge carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Humphreys told the jury that a comment about a burning bush was a prophecy that orders First Amendment protection. The federal jury took about an hour to return a guilty verdict last September. Detective Reese is with the Watertown Police.
You know, there is freedom of speech, but it is illegal to make threats towards the President of the United States. That does not fall under the Freedom of Speech Act, as far as I'm understanding.
Freedom Forum reports that Humphreys, who calls himself Prophet Israel Humphreys, said a similar reference he made in an internet Christian chat room was a joke, and that neither can be viewed as a threat on the president. Humphreys says he has been arrested 25 times, with all but three cases dismissed, and that his indictment on the threat charge was the result of government profiling. For Free Speech Radio News from Portland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Iraqi government submitted its arms declaration to the UN weapons inspectors Saturday, one day ahead of the deadline set by last month's Security Council resolution. Iraq says its 12,000-page report covers civilian activities that could have military uses. It denies having weapons of mass destruction, setting the stage for further confrontation with the Bush administration, which has said such denials could be grounds for war. UN General Secretary Kofi Annan also commented on Iraq's report.
It is up to President Saddam Hussein to disarm, to cooperate fully with the inspectors and honor all his obligations to the United Nations. If that were to be done, I would see no reason for war.
Originally, no country was supposed to have full access to Iraq's written declaration. But the Security Council agreed late yesterday to give the US and four other permanent council members a full copy. Meanwhile, with large-scale military exercises or computerized quote-unquote war games starting today in Iraqi neighboring country Qatar, along with last week's call-up of 10,000 additional reservists, the U.S. seems bent on a track to launch an invasion on Iraq before the desert heat sets in late January. But as Susan Wood reports from the UN, the U.S. drive towards war is putting it on a collision course with other UN members and much of the U.S. public.
In his weekly radio address on Saturday, President Bush said the U.S. would thoroughly examine the Iraqi declaration before passing judgment on its credibility. But U.N. diplomats and analysts expect the U.S. to quickly charge Iraq with being in material breach of Security Council resolutions, setting the stage for war. With military equipment flowing toward the Gulf and 60,000 U.S. troops already in the region, the U.S. could be ready for war within 2 to 3 weeks, according to Colin Robinson, a research analyst with the Center for Defense Information.
There are a large amount of aircraft in the region, spread around Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Kuwait, and Turkey as well. There are continued reports of covert operations going on inside Iraq and special operations training in Jordan. All in all, a large amount of military force already deployed that could make the transition to an offensive force if the soldiers to man the prepositioned army equipment are quickly flown in.
Yet with all its firepower, the U.S. faces political constraints. U.S. troops are stationed in Gulf states Qatar and Kuwait, as well as Saudi Arabia. But only Qatar has indicated it would allow the U.S. to launch strikes from its territory. Turkey's newly elected majority Islamist government has made contradictory statements, and other NATO countries are cool to talk of war without having seen the Iraqi report. James Paul of Global Policy Forum says the U.S. has failed to make its case at the United Nations.
If the United States comes into the Security Council and says, you see, we have these photos, and you see we have this sensor that was in our satellite, and you notice how it blips up here as it goes over Iraq and this kind of thing, it's pretty clear to me that that they're not going to get an automatic okay to start the bombs dropping. Now, they may say we're going to do it anyway, but they're going to be in a sort of funny position there.
Paul says most council members believe that if the U.S. has the solid evidence it claims to have on hidden Iraqi arms programs, it should make that available to U.N. weapons inspectors. Chief arms expert Hans Blix said at the U.N. on Friday he would be grateful for any tips from member countries. But the Bush administration has made no secret of its disdain for Blix, who has repeatedly promised to fire any inspector caught spying for any government. Major peace demonstrations are scheduled around the U.S. on Tuesday, the day the Security Council meets to decide how to handle the Iraqi report. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The nation's second largest airline is bankrupt. United Airlines filed for Chapter 11 protection today, becoming the largest carrier ever to do so. It's the latest bad news for an industry that's projected to lose more than $9 billion this year, and one that's looking to squeeze wages and benefits from its labor unions in order to cut into those losses. John Hamilton reports.
This is United Express service to Denver.
Two-thirds of the seats aboard United Flight 5771 went empty last Friday, and the mood among flight attendants was grim. The Air Transportation Stabilization Board, or ATSB, had just denied United's bid for a loan, and that put the airline on a collision course with a bankruptcy court. Rick is a flight attendant who wouldn't give his last name, but he did offer this assessment of the mood among United employees.
The morale right now is kind of low. People are very concerned about the company and what their longevity would be.
In order to win a government loan and stave off bankruptcy, United had tried to squeeze more than $5 billion in labor costs from its workers. And while pilots and flight attendants agreed to the cuts, United's mechanics balked at the call for concessions. The airline scrambled to negotiate a second agreement on givebacks, but the vote never came. The ATSB denied United's call for a loan, ruling that revenue projections were too optimistic and that the money was unlikely to ever be paid back. Richard Turk has worked for United over the last 14 years. He was among the majority of mechanics in the International Association of Machinists who voted against concessions.
You look at any of the other airlines and you look at their histories, and pay cuts never made a difference in any of the other ones. Eastern, Braniff, Pan Am, these guys all took pay cuts before they went under, and it didn't help.
It's not the first time United has turned to its unions for concessions. In 1994, pilots and machinists agreed to deep wage cuts in exchange for a stake in the company through ESOP, an employee stock ownership program. United employees now control more than half of all United stock, although they can't vote their shares, and that makes the company's bankruptcy all the more painful for employees like Richard Turk.
We took that big pay cut, and now if the stock's down, say, 83 cents, today, I guess I'm out about $57,000, and I know, guys, it'll be out $75,000, and which was, you know, part of your retirement. You can't touch that stock until you retire or quit. It wasn't like a common stock where we could do anything with it, but we've just watched it dwindle away from over $100 a share to nothing now, and we had no control over it.
United's bankruptcy will be the largest in U.S. airline history, but it's not the first of the year. U.S. Air filed for Chapter 11 last August after winning concessions from its unions. It's since laid off thousands of employees and is using bankruptcy protections as leverage over its unions. Jennifer Biddle has worked as a United mechanic since 1995. She says a bankruptcy court could force changes in her union's collective bargaining agreement, something the unions might not have given up voluntarily.
I actually think that the ATSB coming out, as it did, on the eve of a second vote, you know, in a way, I think it was a tactical retreat for the government because they realize that they will be able to use bankruptcy to accomplish the same things that they have wanted to accomplish for many years.
For now, United says it'll continue its flights, but there's a sense among most workers in the airline industry that their jobs could be the next on the chopping block. The country's largest carrier, American Airlines, continues to hemorrhage money. Officials there aren't talking about bankruptcy, though they are following United's lead and asking workers for concessions, a phenomenon that appears likely to continue throughout the rest of the industry. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
Over the weekend, the Bush White House abruptly purged two key members of its economic team, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and Economics Advisor Lawrence Lindsay. This morning, the president nominated a replacement for O'Neill. Lindsay's replacement will likely be named tomorrow. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
The official line is that Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and Economic Advisor Lawrence Lindsay resigned over the weekend, but nobody buys it. The two men were said to be opposed to more tax cuts, which the president favors. The Wall Street Journal reported Monday there's a White House plan for $300 billion in new tax cuts to be sent to Congress next month. The head of CSX, which is the biggest railroad concern in the U.S., was nominated for O'Neill's job today. John Snow says he's ready to follow the president's lead.
Should the United States Senate confirm me, I look forward to joining your economic team to advance a pro-growth, pro-jobs agenda.
The choice of Snow should make Wall Street happy. He's the former chairman of the Business Roundtable, lobbying Washington on behalf of American CEOs. The White House hasn't named a replacement for Economic Advisor Lawrence Lindsay, but the financial press is speculating they'll choose investment banker Stephen Friedman of Goldman Sachs. Democrats say they're less worried about the individuals selected for high economic posts than they are about White House economic policy. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle this morning.
It isn't the names, but the plan that is of concern to us. Trickle-down economics doesn't work.
Unemployment numbers are up, as reported last week. According to government statistics, 6% of Americans are out of work. Nearly all the lost jobs belonged to African Americans, whose official unemployment rate soared to around 11%. Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee this afternoon.
It is well known that African Americans, even in this new century, are the last hired and the first fired. But overall, America's economy is teetering. There's been no policies by the administration that has addressed extending the unemployment compensation, stop gaps to make sure that we have a good trade policy, but that we also address the question of jobs being lost going overseas. We have no policy in helping those bottom line workers who are not even getting reasonable compensation through an increase in the minimum wage. We've been fighting to increase the minimum wage now for almost the entire last session.
It's unlikely Sheila Jackson Lee's priorities will be addressed by the new Bush economic team, according to Robert E. Scott at the Economic Policy Institute in D.C. Scott says the White House is concerned more about tax cuts for a different demographic group of Americans.
The tax cut that President Bush asked for and got in 2000 was worth about $1.3 trillion over 10 years. Now, that was not enough to do the job for two reasons. It was small. It amounted to only a few tens of billions of dollars in the front, and it was heavily weighted with benefits for the wealthiest consumers who don't spend tax savings.
Benefits for more than 800,000 unemployed workers expire on December 28th. No word whether benefits will be extended when Congress comes back January 7th under Republican control. President Bush is expected to name a replacement economic advisor tomorrow. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Last Friday was the 10th anniversary of the destruction of the Babri Masjid, a 16th century mosque in northern India. The mosque was destroyed by Hindu activists who believe a temple should be built on what they say is the birthplace of the Hindu deity Lord Ram. The 1992 demolition led to widespread violence across India and brought the Hindu nationalist BJP to power. Now, as Gujarat prepares for its elections this Thursday, December 12, the anniversary is bringing more tension to the Muslim population of Gujarat. As Binu Alex reports from Gujarat, the state elections will have the final say on the hardline Hindu policies of the ruling BJP government.
Jai Shri Ram!
This is the chant that thousands of Hindu hardliners shouted as they destroyed a 16th century mosque in the northern Indian city of Ayodhya 10 years ago. The violence that ensued killed more than 2,000 in Bombay alone and shot Ayodhya into international limelight. This violence still plagues India 10 years later. Now its epicenter is Gujarat state, some 500 miles from Ayodhya. Kaushik Mehta is the Gujarat secretary of the VHP, or World Hindu Council, which aims to make India a pure Hindu nation.
The struggle for building the temple began in 1984, but still we have not been able to build our temple. We have a common earth, common sky, and common place to live, but still we don't have a uniform civil code.
The matter is now in Indian courts. It was the destruction of mosque in Ayodhya that heightened religious violence across India. 10 years later, history repeated itself. Last spring, 58 Hindu activists were burnt in a train returning from Ayodhya. In the subsequent violence that followed, some 2,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed in Gujarat. Professor J.S. Bandukwala, who describes himself as a moderate Muslim, believes that just as in Ayodhya, the Gujarat violence was also planned by the Hindu activists.
This type of planning cannot be done in just a matter of 12 hours. This is too thorough. It requires complete checking from municipal records and all.
Muslim leaders like Amin Sheikh says the tactics divide Hindus and Muslims, which brought the BJP to power, will not work.
If you look at history, the people who have used fascism as a tool to govern have not lasted long. There are polling systems where small margins matter. Muslims have special relations with Allah, and in circumstances like this, we fear none but Allah. These fascists have made the atmosphere so bad that people are just not willing to listen to each other.
But Kaushik Mehta of the VHP insists that India will be governed by Hindu ideology.
The World Hindu Council wants the country to run social and political culture on the lines of Hinduism. We are actively making it possible.
BJP Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee has not yet fulfilled his party's promise to build a temple on the site of the destroyed mosque. Maybe pressures from his coalition partners have prevented him, but Hindu hardliners refuse to give up. Political analyst Achyut Yagnik says the Hindu ideology, which swept the BJP to national power in 1999, is actually on the wane among the urban middle class who forms its major support base.
There is a beginning of the process of disenchantment among urban middle class. Some kind of distancing, because they think that the cycles of violence has affected, and it will be very difficult for them to come out of this critical phase.
According to Yagnik, Gujarat is the last remaining place in India for the VHP and other Hindu activists to implement their hardline nationalist agenda. If they succeed and win the elections, they may replicate it all over the country. Gujarat is one of the three states where BJP is in power. Without any governing experience and a number of political scandals clouding their image, experts believe this will be BJP's last term in power. This election will make or break the Hindu hardline agenda in India. From Ahmedabad, Gujarat, I'm Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
2.3 billion people use public transportation in New York City every year. That's one out of every three people using mass transit in the U.S. And now, transit workers here are facing a looming deadline. On December 15, the union contract with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority covering 34,000 subway and bus operators runs out. Nell Geiser files this report from New York City.
New York transit workers have voted to strike. The transit workers' union says the MTA hasn't negotiated in good faith, waiting until last Friday to present a proposal.
Our members were incensed that the MTA would wait until just 10 days before the expiration of our contract to put an offer on the table.
President of TWU Local 100, Roger Toussaint, spoke Saturday after a mass membership meeting in Midtown Manhattan. The union's members voted to authorize the executive board to call a strike if negotiations fail.
Our members are aware of the consequences of a strike. After all, we live here unlike the members of the MTA board, but we also know that we cannot live under the terms that the MTA is trying to impose upon us.
Citing a $2.7 billion deficit, the MTA's proposal for the three-year contract includes a wage freeze this year, followed by raises based on productivity in the second 2 years. The union says these terms are unacceptable and is asking for a 24% wage increase over the 3 years of the contract. An average transit worker earns $44,000 a year.
The Transport Workers Union has negotiated in good faith, but the MTA seems intent on forcing a strike, something New Yorkers just can't afford.
That's part of an advertisement the transit union is running on New York City radio stations, urging people to call Governor Pataki and ask him to back the union in negotiations this week. Support from Albany is not forthcoming, however, and Mayor Bloomberg is threatening to arrest anyone who strikes. Public employees are barred from striking under New York's Taylor Law. The TWU says safety is also especially important in light of recent fatalities. Two track maintenance workers, Curry and Baby and Joy Anthony, were killed by oncoming trains last month, highlighting safety procedures the union says are not on par with federal standards. 21 workers have been killed by trains in the past 2 decades, and the TWU says the recent deaths are due in part to MTA negligence. President Roger Toussaint.
There were rules and regulations that they were aware of, that their supervisors were violating. And there's strong indication that there was negligence at hand that led to these deaths. And therefore, it's only appropriate that you have a grand jury investigation. We think that that would be fitting.
Tony Earle is vice president for safety with the union. He says more stringent safety procedures must be part of the contract.
By all means, we're not ready to sacrifice safety. And we're just looking to get a fair and decent contract. I've been with the transit for like 27 years, and I've never heard the MTA or any other bosses or managers say when contract time comes that their pockets are not empty and they need more productivity.
Besides more productivity, the MTA is asking for higher co-pays on the workers' health plans. The authority is offering to increase the health plans by $22 million, but the union says that's undermined by forcing workers to pay more for services. The negotiations continue through this week, and union officials and members say they're still hopeful for an agreement by the Sunday deadline. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in New York.
And finally, we end on a sad note. Surrounded by his family and community, renowned peace activist Philip Berrigan passed away from cancer at his home in Baltimore, Maryland. He was 79. With the support of his community, he was arrested over 100 times and spent 11 years of his life behind bars for nonviolent civil resistance. Laurel Padgett Seekins brings us this reflection on his faith, commitment, and community.
Born in 1923, Philip Berrigan, the youngest of six Irish Catholic boys, joined the army and fought in World War II. When he returned from Europe, he followed his brother Dan into the Catholic priesthood. Sent by his order to the Deep South, he joined the civil rights movement, which led to his opposition to the war in Vietnam. On May 17, 1968, he participated in one of the defining actions against the Vietnam War, the Catonsville Nine.
We went to a suburb of Baltimore, and we this time took the 1A files out of the draft boards there and burned them in the parking lot.
And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation.
Phil's life of resistance is a testimony to his faith. He looked to the Christian scripture for instruction on how to live and work for a nonviolent world. In 1980, acting on the Old Testament prophecy of Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares, he, along with seven others, entered a General Electric nuclear weapons plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and hammered on nuclear warheads. Phil thinks the Spirit helped them and all who have followed in the plowshares movement.
I think faith has a great deal to do with always finding the weapons and always doing what you intend to do to them, because they're so anti-human, and because the God we try to be faithful to is all about the human. We say God is a God of compassion.
His faith led to deep commitments and a willingness to take risks. It also helped him through the 11 long years he spent behind bars as a result of his actions. For Phil, commitment and risk-taking are required to build a dedicated peace movement. He expressed this belief in a tape he made while underground after the Catonsville Nine sentencing.
You know, you don't build a movement without people. Building a movement or building a revolution is essentially a community operation, as I see it. So there again, I would focus on a politics that would build a movement, because it would influence people, bring them to a higher level of consciousness and a higher degree of risk in their lives, realizing that their identity is impossible unless they take risk for their brothers.
Phil's commitment was grounded in community, which he felt provides the necessary support for a life of resistance and also holds an individual to higher responsibilities. In 1973, Phil and his wife Liz McAllister founded Jonah House, a resistance community in Baltimore, Maryland, where they raised their three children.
It's a nonviolent, very simply, a nonviolent resistance community. We don't say one of our priorities is serving the poor, though we do an awful lot of work in behalf of the poor. We hold all things in common. We practice voluntary poverty. The community has paid quite a sizable price, not only in actions, but also in jail time. We speak of a revolving door between prison and what we call minimum security, which is living in this society.
Figuring out the life of resistance was an ongoing process for Philip Berrigan. And in one of his last interviews, he expressed optimism for the future.
Very, very, very hopeful. Very hopeful.
May others share his hope as they continue the struggle for faith, commitment, and community in their own lives and actions. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Laurel Padgett Seekins with assistance from Scott Gurian, Democracy Now!, and the Pacifica Radio Archives.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.